Welcome back to another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. Three of us are just still here hanging out. My name's Katie Givens, and I'm not a lawyer.
I'm Kelly Turner. I'm not a doctor.
My name is Scott Wright. I'm a mediocre journalist. And can we tell everybody that it is the week after Halloween? Can we talk about Halloween for a second before we get started? We're doing something that has something to do with Halloween.
Yes, we are.
But technically, today is November the 1st here in this room where we are sitting right now. Mm-hmm.
But it'll be the 3rd when this drops.
So this will drop 2 days from now. Mm-hmm. So did everybody get what they wanted for Halloween this time? I mean, I didn't get my damn costume. It's still sitting on a shipping container somewhere off the coast of California. My green tracksuit from Squid Game did not appear in time.
We have plenty of candy. I can tell you that.
I want Kit Kats.
Oh, we got a ton of those.
Please bring us.
We do have them.
Thank you.
Yes.
That is the worst. Like, you cost the something that you only need one night a year, not arriving
bucks.
In time.
Mm-hmm. 2 weeks ago.
And see, next year, it's not going to make any sense.
Well, they're renewing it for season 2, so my fingers are crossed.
Well, maybe they'll drop it next year about this time, and then you'll have it, and so you're ready for next year. So what did you go as
I'm hoping
this
it's
year?
Here by then. Well, I just went with my old standby. I have a Superman t-shirt in the closet, and so when somebody asked me what my uniform or my costume was, I just pulled down the top of my shirt to expose just enough Superman logo for people to know, and then went, shh, don't tell anybody.
And he wears glasses for those who don't know. Yeah. So the Clark Kent thing.
I got his whole Clark Kent thing going.
I don't think Clark Kent wore a Superman shirt, though.
And he was not a mediocre journalist either. He was a good journalist when he was there.
But that's good. You got a backup.
He is a journalist. That's good. Yeah. That's good.
That's
so you did have you had a backup. So that's good.
I did.
I like that.
That's okay. It. That's my whole Halloween story.
Katie, how did yours go?
Oh, it went great. We had a big party at Easy Street.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Everything went wonderful.
Some costume.
Yeah.
Were there anything memorable?
We had some unicorns that, you know, the big blow up costumes.
Oh.
Three unicorns, and they took up the whole dance floor.
They did.
I love that.
Yeah,
loved
that was
it.
Pretty much the extent of everybody's ability to dance was the three people in their blow up unicorn.
Loved it.
Costumes.
That's fun.
I assume they won first place, right?
They did. Well, in the couple's costume category, they did.
Okay. So,
who won the single costume?
Jerry Tucker, and he was very excited because he came to win.
Was that whole...
What was he?
He was like a ringleader kind of too, kind of like what I had on, but mm-hmm. he had this whole face thing going on. I wish I could describe it.
He looked like one of the sand people from Star Wars. To me.
Oh, wow.
He had an inspo pic he showed me, and he nailed it.
Okay.
Wow.
Well, well-deserved award, then.
It was, you know, it was applause-based, too, so, you know, mm-hmm. you just had to be a crowd favorite.
Oh, yeah, nice job, then. Yes, well, congratulations to all the winners of the party at Easy Street this past weekend.
First annual
Halloween costume contest. The party and mm-hmm. everything else that it was involved. Yep. The freaks were out.
Oh, they were. The Shane Givens band played. Of course they were.
Yes, they were.
So that's good. That's a success, right?
Yes.
Scott, you didn't go trick-or-treating and you didn't get any candy.
I told you I need Kit Kats.
Gosh. Well, you're supposed to go on Halloween night to people's homes and ask for those Kit Kats. Yeah, you know where Kelly lives.
I was hanging out with you last night watching the Braves. That's true. Opened up Easy Street. Very special occasion on Sunday. We are not usually open on Sunday at Easy Street, but last night, because we had several requests... Mm-hmm. And the Braves are in the World Series.
And they could have clinched.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. I think we were the jinx, because normally we would not be open, and we were last night. And the Braves started strong.
Mm-hmm. Grand slam
in the first inning, but then they lost 9-5. So they have to play. Today's a travel day.
Yep, and they play tomorrow.
So they'll play again on Tuesday, which is yesterday if you're listening now.
So yesterday, this could all be irrelevant. If the Braves won or if the Astros won, we don't know.
Yeah, otherwise, the game's at 7 tonight.
Congratulations to the Braves. We don't know yet. We'll see. Okay.
But yeah, we ran out of weeks in October to tell Halloween stories, so here we are.
We did. And the thing about crime in Alabama is... there's a lot of them that we could relate to Halloween. It's going to get worse. Next week is even scarier.
Yeah. Mm. It's the gift that keeps on giving.
It really is. But this week, we're going to talk about a crime. We're going to talk about a killer that has been called the Halloween killer. And it's not because he dresses up like Michael Myers or anything like that, but it's because he murdered a man very brutally on Halloween night, 2005. So I've got a little bit of a convoluted way to tell the story, but it worked at the live show. So we're going to go with that.
It did.
Again. So if you were at the live show, you heard some of this story. All right. So Halloween night, 2005, the Madison Police Department was called to a Chevron gas station because a man was there claiming to be the victim of a shooting. So we had some first responders there, Officer Watson, Officer McAlphin, and Sergeant Jordan. When they arrived, they found a man covered in blood and sitting on the curb of the Chevron. They asked him to lift his shirt, and they saw two gunshot wounds, one in the center of his chest, the other on the side of his chest. They asked him, "How did you get shot?" He said, "I have no idea. I don't know anything. All I know is I've been shot." They asked him, "How did he get to the Chevron?" He said he did not remember. So at this point, Officer Watson is going to start looking around the parking lot of the Chevron, and he's going to focus in on a white Nissan Altima parked in front of the gas station. And the reason he's going to focus in on this car is because he's going to notice some blood on the outside of the door, and he's going to say, "You know what? I'm going to go there first and check this out.
Maybe that's how you got here."
Uh-huh. So he just kind of glances inside the car, and in he sees blood on the steering wheel and blood on the front dash. He noticed an insulated pizza bag, a police scanner, and a bloody knife with a broken tip. Now, this is going to add to the confusion already at the gas station, because the man on the curb, what? What's wrong with the man on the curb?
Well, he's got two gunshot
wounds. He's been shot. Yeah. And he's,
so there's probably blood.
Exactly. So, but he's seeing a bloody knife. He's not seeing anything in the car just yet. He's just glancing into the car. So after he tells the sergeant what he has seen in the Altima, the sergeant calls back to the Madison Police Department and asks for a search in Madison County and the surrounding areas for a recent shooting. Well, one county over, the Athens Police Department responds and says, "Oh, yes, we can answer this." So they give them information from a call they received at 7:34 p.m. on that night. They go on to describe a crime scene at the home of Athens resident Mr. Charles Newman. And after hearing the response from the Athens Police Department, they search the Altima at the Chevron. And what they find in the Altima is going to tell a story of a very gruesome and a violent murder. So let's talk about our actual victim. Over one county over in Athens, Alabama. Everybody know where that is?
Yes.
It's kind of up near,
it's up there,
near the
close
Huntsville
to the,
area.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we're in northern Alabama.
We've
this
been
week.
Near this area a lot.
Yeah, it seems like the water's got something
just
in it up there.
Just be careful if you're up in that area. Mm-hmm. So our victim, Mr. Charles Newman, was a World War II veteran and a paratrooper in the 101st Airborne Division. Mr. Newman was in the D-Day invasion in Normandy, France in 1944. He was 80 years old. He was a retired contractor. He was described as being very cautious, often carrying a gun on him at all times, even when he was in his robe. So at 7:34 on Halloween night, 2005, a 911 call comes into the Athens Police Department. But no one's talking to the person who answers the phone. You know, they said 911.
Right.
No one's saying anything. All they can hear is background noise and a background conversation. So they quickly figure out the victim is in distress and cannot actually talk to us, and we're hearing the background noise.
Okay.
And I wonder, it would be interesting to talk to someone who answers the phone for 911 to see how many times this actually happens for them and how quickly they're able to figure out, oh, we're, you know, they've called, but they're trying to be secretive about it.
It sounds like a good idea for a future show.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would love to know how often this actually happens, that people are able to actually get that call out but not talk to anybody, and they're trying to pick up on that. Mm-hmm. So they pick up on this conversation, and what they hear is an older gentleman saying, "Don't do that. Leave me alone. What do you want?" And then they hear a younger man who's saying the same thing over and over. "Where is the vault? Where is the vault?" Over and over. So Athens is going to send patrol officer Katrina Flanagan and her partner to Mr. Newman's home. So she enters the home. She finds the back door open, but the glass storm door was closed. And on this glass door, there was blood. She finds Mr. Newman in the back of the house between the couch and a table in a puddle of blood. His dentures had been knocked out, and they found the portable phone that had been used to call 911. They see a set of bloody footprints leading to the back door that has blood on it, that, you know, to exit the house. Mm. Now, in the meantime, Madison County, one county over, they are conducting their investigation of the bloody man on the curb of the Chevron. So after they hear about all of this that's happened at Mr. Newman's house in Athens, they're going to search this Nissan Altima. This is what they find in the Nissan Altima. Now, as previously mentioned, they found an insulated pizza bag, a police scanner, and a bloody knife with a broken tip. They're also going to find night vision goggles, blood-stained eyeglasses, two black gym bags, packs of batteries, a utility belt, a roll of duct tape, a Rossi brand 38 revolver, an 8mm starter pistol, a rental agreement for the Nissan Altima signed by someone with the name Andrew Lackey, a stun gun missing an electrode, a baseball bat glove, two flashlights, two black tube socks filled with nylon rope, super glue, an axe, a sledgehammer, a hammer wrapped in a towel, screwdrivers, a wallet with a driver's license belonging to Andrew Lackey, several credit cards, and a PayPal card for someone by the name of Jacob McDeal. So, Scott, can you piece together what happened by the contents of this car?
No, it sounds like a poor man's Batman is trying to become a vigilante, and I don't think that's what this is.
No, that's a lot of stuff.
That's a lot of stuff.
That is, I mean, that's quite the list to be in this. A Nissan Altima is not a very big car.
Sounds like some thought went into what went into the trunk of that car.
Exactly. So as the investigation continues, authorities are able to put together what actually happened on Halloween night, 2005. Now, to fully understand this, let me take you back several years to the Spark school system when two fourth grade boys became friends. Derek Newman, Mr. Charles Newman, our victim, his grandson is Derek. And he becomes friends with another fourth grader named Andrew Lackey. And they share the same interests in video gaming. Andrew was a quiet kid and sometimes described as shy. Now, over the years of the two of them being friends, Derek told Andrew that his grandfather had a vault in his house. And in this vault, there contained gold bars and a lot of cash. So this, like, it becomes this story, you know, that he, mm-hmm. that Derek tells about his, you know, veteran grandfather.
Right.
He has this vault, these gold bars.
As if to imply that he came home from Europe with gold bars and a bunch of German marks
Yeah, a lot of interesting, yes.
All right.
A lot of things in this vault. The vault was believed to be located in a room under the stairs in Mr. Newman's house. So, when we look at the time of the attack, and authorities are going to look very closely at everything, they're going to figure out that Derek's family and Derek, they are estranged from Mr. Newman at the time of this attack. Now, I don't know if when the boys were in school together, if they were estranged at that point. I'm not sure at what point they became estranged.
Okay.
But these are the tales of Derek, and he's telling this to Andrew. Which is, you know, if you'll remember back to the 911 call, you hear the younger voice saying, where is the vault? Where is the vault?
I'm starting to piece this together a little bit.
I promise, I'm going to tie this up in a nice little bow for you. Okay. So after finishing school at Spark High School, Andrew is going to work as an eBay trader. And this is going to be good for Andrew because he doesn't really shine in social situations. So this is good for him to be an eBay trader. And the name that he uses as an eBay trader is Jacob McDeal.
Was that on the PayPal card that you found in the trunk?
In the Altima.
Okay.
Correct. All right. So he's also a member of several chat groups. Now, remember in 2005, I'm sure you could still be a member of chat groups, but they were a bigger thing, I feel like. Yeah. And maybe I'm just not tech savvy enough, but I feel like the chat room is Not as popular, or is it? I don't know.
I don't know. I think we mentioned this in the live show. I remember about that time, one of the most prolific thing about the internet was that you got an envelope in the mail, a small cardboard envelope, and it had an AOL disk in it. And you you put that into your tower computer, and it connected you to AOL, and it opened up the entire world of the internet to you. It gave you a cheap browser, and you could talk to anybody in the world. There were hundreds and hundreds of chat rooms. Yeah. That was a big thing back then.
I feel like chat rooms more or less replaced by like forums now.
Yes,
maybe?
I would think so. Like in Reddit threads,
Threads, and things like that. So that's going to be a little more modern day, a little more 2021. But back then, chat rooms were a big deal. So he's also a member of several chat groups, and he uses that same name, Jacob McDeal, in these chat rooms. So as the investigation unfolds, they're going to get a computer analyst to come in and take a look at Andrew Lackey's computer. And what this computer analyst is going to discover is that under the name Jacob McDeal, Andrew chats with many people, and one of the people that he's chatting with is a person named Damien, and it's going to perk their ears, the content of the chat conversation, because they're Jacob McDeal, which is really Andrew Lackey,
right?
And this person named Damien are going to share several messages plotting and planning this crime.
This very particular crime.
They're talking about how they're going to stake out the house. They're going to learn the habits of Mr. Newman. And then finally, they're going to carry out the robbery and attack. Now, the plan is to enter the house under the false pretense of delivering free pizza to Mr. Newman. If you will remember, back in the Altima, there's an insulated pizza bag.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought he was an actual police pizza delivery.
Mm-hmm. Nope, that's the ruse to get into the home of Mr. Newman is to have, free pizza, you know. And I guess he chose Halloween night because that might seem like a promotional thing that a pizza company
or maybe, the neighbor ordered the pizza, they don't want it.
Here you go, would you like this? Yeah. Right.
Or you wouldn't be startled by someone being at the door on Halloween night.
On Halloween night, right, right. So that obviously was decided upon, planned out, and this computer analyst is able to pull this from these chat rooms. The messages and chats went on for several months before finally coming to an end in July of 2005. So a few months before the actual attack happened is when the chats ended. Now the authorities are going to look into this because they want to know who this Damien is. Turns out Damien is a random person in England. Just some random person.
Somebody he's made friends with in this chat room.
Mm-hmm. And they're just plotting and talking. And I don't know why you would do that, why you would even chat about something like that online.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, that's quickly dismissed because obviously someone in England can't carry out this crime in northern Alabama.
I don't know. There are jet planes and whatnot.
There are jet planes. And the discussion did stop in July of 2005. But as they go through this crime scene, the DNA evidence is going to suggest that there's only one other person, the one person involved.
Okay.
So the authorities are going to determine Damien's out and he's from England, and that Jacob was the alias used by Andrew Lackey. So they're going to put all this together. So here is what happened after they piece everything together. He drove to Mr. Newman's house on Halloween night. He attempted to rob Mr. Newman. You go back to the 911 call. He's saying, where is the vault? Where is the vault?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mr. Newman was a cautious man, if you'll remember me telling you that. And even if he's in his robe and pajamas, he's got his gun with him. I imagine if you are a World War II veteran, you've seen the kind of things that you see in Normandy.
You think you can't possibly be surprised by anything that you would see the rest of your life after that.
Exactly. It's terribly traumatic event. I could also understand always having a gun on you.
Sure.
At all times. Even now that you're in 2005, so many years later, decades later, you're 80 years old, you're a retired contractor, but still, I could understand that.
You have seen human beings at their worst.
Absolutely.
For probably months on end. I mean,
I can't even begin to imagine what everything that they saw. I mean, I can watch Band of Brothers and I can read it.
That's
and I can watch Saving Private Ryan, but I will never know exactly what was seen, what was heard, what was felt by the individuals who survived D-Day.
Yeah.
Just never. So you can, it makes sense to me that he's still a very cautious man. So Mr. Newman shoots Andrew 2 times during the attack, in the chest and in the side. Andrew is still able to overpower Mr. Newman, and he stabbed him. I read 2 different accounts of the stabbing. One account says 54 times. Another account says 70.
Both of those are excessive numbers.
Yep. Upwards, more than 50 times, he stabbed Mr. Newman, including in the head and in his eyes. He hit Mr. Newman in the face and broke his nose. So probably used either the hammer, the sledgehammer, whatever was in that car.
Mm-hmm.
Both items were in the car. And Mr. Newman died of massive blood loss, it was determined. But he also had gunshots that were inflicted upon him after he was dead. So Andrew was obviously making sure that Mr. Newman was dead. So he shoots him
With his own gun.
With his own gun, and then takes it with him. Now, they're going to interview the 911 operator, and the 911 operator is going to have some more news for them as far as Mr. Newman's last words. Remember we said he's saying, don't do that, leave me alone, mm-hmm. those kind of things. But Mr. Newman's actual last words to Andrew Lackey were, please come sit down and let me pray for you. Can you imagine?
I can't.
Those being your last words to someone who's busted into your home, trying to rob you, and you're saying, come sit down with me, let me pray for you. That's unbelievable. What a hero, what a wonderful man Mr. Newman, Mr. Charles Newman was. So they believe that the motive for this attack, because at this point, why? You know, we've established a connection with Derek talking about the vault.
Right. I mean, that's it, right, as far as we know.
But he's an eBay trader, but apparently Andrew had developed a drug problem and needed money.
There you go.
And at this time, at the time of this crime, Andrew Lackey is 22 years old.
Well, maybe the fact that he doesn't remember how he got to the Chevron station and he's stabbed someone at least 50 times. I mean, that sounds like a mad rampage. And then the last thing you do is you pick up the other person's gun and you...
After you've hit him in the face with either a hammer or a sledgehammer. Just
one last fit of anger.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really? You're going to shoot me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sounds like a person who's on drugs.
Right. I feel like if I'm sober and I'm shot twice, I'm probably going to go down.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to keep going back.
Excellent
I don't
point.
Know. I mean, I don't know for sure, but I've never been in a drug-induced fit of rage.
Right.
So I can't speak from personal experience and been shot at the same time. So I don't know. But I feel like if you're, that's a very good point, Scott. If you're in some kind of fit, like in a rage, 2 gunshots are not going to, I mean, I'm going to run out of the house.
Yeah. I mean, apparently not.
Yeah.
I mean, we've established that you have established that he has a drug problem. Mm-hmm. We have all established that he got shot twice and still managed to commit this murder and climb back in the car and drive down to the local gas station.
Mm-hmm. A 1 county over. And this is not, I would say, from my sources that I've been looking at articles from AL.com and other places, but what they're saying is it's about a 15-minute drive.
Okay.
So not a 5-minute drive.
Right.
15 minutes at least. I mean, to be shot twice and then to be able to sit there and talk to people. He goes to the Chevron and I could never get a sense of if Andrew actually called the cops or if someone at the Chevron called the cops.
Yeah. See a guy climb out of a car covered in blood
and he's just
stumbling around mm-hmm. or sitting on a curb looking confused and
mm-hmm.
you know, we would all go, that's not right.
Well, you could see how it would be. Either one. I mean, mm-hmm. if he realizes he's injured pretty badly, he's going to want some help. Or the person in the Chevron is like, whoa, not today.
Right.
911.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So in Mr. Newman's house, they are going to find an electrode from a stun gun. Do you remember?
Does I remember you familiar? Said there was one that was missing.
So in the car that Andrew Lackey, I don't know why I'm pointing. I pointed okay. away from me. But in the car that Andrew Lackey is driving, that is at the Chevron, the Nissan Altima, it has a stun gun missing an electrode. Well, they find an electrode from a stun gun in Mr. Newman's house. They find the bill of sale for the Rossi brand 38 revolver, which is how they learn that's Mr. Newman's gun in that rental car of Andrew Lackey.
Okay.
So before Andrew is even out of the hospital, because he has to go to the hospital and be treated for his injuries, he's charged with capital murder. The forensic scientist tested DNA on Andrew and on the steering wheel and the door of Mr. Newman's house, and they all matched Andrew. It was Andrew's blood. So they were able to physically put him in the house. The DNA both had Mr. Newman's DNA. The gun had Mr. Newman's DNA and Andrew's DNA. And then Mr. Newman's DNA was on Andrew's shoes and pants from that night. So they're able to link him to the house. The bloody shoe prints matched the boots. And something else they're going to tie up in a nice bow for the jury is they're going to find a piece of metal in Mr. Newman's skull, and they're going to match that to that bloody knife missing the tip.
Missing the tip.
In the Altima. So they're going to link him to that home six ways from Sunday.
Sounds like a district attorney's dream so far. I mean, the prosecutor who is in charge of this feels like at this point he's got this one wrapped up, like you said.
Nice little bow for the jury. Let me just tell you how he was there and everything, and they're able to piece everything together. So at that point, I'm going to turn this over to Katie to talk to you about the trial.
So his defense attorney originally decides that they're going to talk about that childhood friend, Derek Newman, and they're going to paint him as a real controlling influence in Andrew's life. They really want to hammer home the points of, well, he only knew about this vault only wanted to enter this home because of the vault that Derek was telling him about, and Derek kept mentioning it, and really a whole lot of Derek that came out of nowhere from most people.
From fourth grade, and this kid's 22 at the time.
Exactly.
Okay.
And to my knowledge, they did not continue to be friends throughout their adult life.
Yeah.
I didn't see anything in
that. I saw nothing, yeah.
Right.
His attorney said he lived in a different world from other people. I said he immersed himself in video games, described himself as a computer geek, and then the term geek was used quite a bit in this trial, to the extent that one article I read quoted that he used the geek defense, which I had never heard of.
And so that defense would be, I'm just so involved in my computer and my gaming, I don't see regular people as humans.
Yeah, I'm not living in this reality anymore.
Okay.
I mean, are we going to get to the video game defense where he shot and stabbed people as if they were characters in a game and didn't? I don't know that that matters, but
he didn't really go any further into that. He just
maybe just the implication for the jury. Hey, geek defense.
I would just say, if you're not living in reality, two gunshots to the chest should bring you right back to it.
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, you don't feel that in your computer games. That's real pain.
Yeah. So, there was a psychologist who did examine him and testified that he was socially awkward and showed signs of autism, but didn't appear to have any serious mental disorder. He, of course, did not take the stand in his own trial. He had four separate indictments, one for capital murder during a burglary, one for capital murder during a robbery, one for burglary, one for robbery. So he's got multiple things he's on trial for here.
And we've learned about that, how there's a difference between murder and capital murder. If you kill someone while you're also taking something away from them, right, then that's where capital murder comes into play.
Right. Okay. And so he is found guilty, there is a 2.5 hour deliberation by the jury, and they come back guilty on all four counts.
All right. Sounds right.
And the trial lasted 3 days, and we consulted Shane about this after the live show, and apparently that's about normal on a capital murder case, three days.
You would think it would take longer. I guess you just would. Maybe that's from the movies.
Yeah.
There's this big sensational trial that lasts for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. So 3 days, then 2.5 hours of jury deliberation. He's found guilty.
That's quick.
Yeah. And he does get to speak after that, and he does not apologize to the victim's family for what he does. He states that his life is over anyway, so he is not going to ask the jury to save his life. He states that Derek was not involved in anything, and he thanks his family for being with him through it all. So there's a sentencing hearing a little ways later, and he is sentenced to death. He's sent to prison, and he's in Atmore, which is where that's where death row inmates.
We've said Atmore plenty of times on this show, and that's where if you get the death sentence, and who knows if it will ever be carried out with all the complications about carrying out death sentences in other states, including this one. So,
well, if you get the death sentence and you're a male, right?
Correct. Yeah, yeah, I guess it's Tutwiler.
Right.
If you're Tutwiler is the only place
in Alabama. Yeah.
He's sitting in prison, and he has a failed suicide attempt. He is officially diagnosed with what at the time they called Asperger syndrome, and he was taking medication. And in 2012, there is another hearing. He fires his court-appointed attorney at the time. He takes the stand on his own defense, and he says he wants to be executed. He said he's remorseful for what he'd done, and he's ready just to pay for his crime, and he's tired of waiting around for it.
Wow. Imagine that, where the best outcome for you is to plug me in, put the hat on. Well, it's not the electric chair in Alabama anymore.
It's lethal injection.
It's lethal injection, but, you know, strap me down, give me the injection, let's get this over with.
Yeah, he waives all of his appeals. He's like, I'm not interested in pursuing any further appeals. He has like a family friend who is an attorney who kind of intervenes on his behalf too, and says he doesn't want to deal with any appeals. There's a coalition called the Equal Justice Initiative, or EJI for short. And they like to intervene on with death row inmates, and they just want to make sure that there's no one that's mentally disabled on death row, because that is illegal.
Right.
And they just really want to make sure that the people who are on death row need to be there.
I would say that's a very good.
Yeah. Noble cause.
Yes, exactly.
And they argue that the judge should have him properly evaluated before setting an execution date. And he's waived all of these mental evaluations. And they're like, well, he shouldn't be able to waive these evaluations. Yeah. He should, you know, that's a cause to say he.
Yeah, that sounds like a catch 22. We've got to determine if he's capable of making this decision, but he's making a decision not to be evaluated, and you're letting him get away with it. So, yeah I get it.
We think he should be evaluated anyway, correct? That's what they're thinking.
Yeah. With him saying these things, with him waiving his appeals, he's acting erratically. He's young.
I don't see anything wrong with that. I mean, I feel like I would want that. If I'm putting myself in the judge's shoes, I'm probably going to want that evaluation just to check a box, really. I mean, I'm not just saying throw away his life and check my box, but I'm saying let's just see. It's not going to hurt anything by doing this.
Sure. I mean, as a judge who's sworn to uphold the Constitution of the United States and the state of Alabama in this case, if I want to sleep tight tonight,
correct,
make sure I do my job. Mm-hmm. And I don't know exactly what that is. Maybe we're going to get to it, but yeah.
And he wrote letters, or at least a letter, to the Alabama Supreme Court asking for them to set an execution date. He started the letter off with the phrase, "This is an odd request."
He's aware.
Yeah.
This is odd.
And so that appeals court allows the judge's ruling to stand, and they set an execution date.
Was he ever evaluated completely?
No.
Wow.
Is he still alive today?
No.
No.
Okay.
He was executed on July 25th, 2013 at age 29.
All right.
And this case gets brought up a lot. There's a lot of controversy surrounding his execution, because, of course, you have EJI looking into it, but you have other organizations and people saying he's on the spectrum and we shouldn't execute someone on the spectrum. However, you hear from family members of people who are, they have loved ones who've been diagnosed as being on the spectrum, and they will tell you it's not a mental illness. And
it's,
that
it's a level of social awkwardness. Is that a way to describe it?
And
accurately?
I think at the end of the day, what they determined was that Andrew knew exactly what he was doing was wrong. He tried to cover it up. He planned it out. There was a lot of planning that went into this crime.
Certainly.
And at the end of the day, that's the question, right, Katie?
Yes.
Do you understand what you're doing is wrong?
Are you mentally competent?
And he's saying over and over.
I think it was argued that he's very mentally competent.
That I did wrong. Mm-hmm. And I don't want any of all this circus. I just want to pay the price for
the wrongest of wrongs. Mm-hmm. Right.
And let's just talk about that wrong. I mean, stabbing someone over 50 times in the eyes, hitting someone with a heavy object like a hammer or sledgehammer in the face, then shooting the person, and there's no vault. This is for nothing.
Yep.
There is no vault, by the way.
Right.
Newman's house.
I don't even think he really got to hang around to look hard for it.
No, because he got shot, and then it's almost like it sent him into a fit of rage. Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems, you know, and we won't get into it. We won't dig down too deep, but how many cases have we done like this where it starts out as a robbery? There's some misinformation. We think there's something inside this house, so we're going to go in and make you tell us where it is. And then at some point you realize you've been duped either by bad information or your fourth grade friend who made up a story because it sounded cool about his grandfather or whatever this turns out to be. Mm-hmm. And you panic.
Don't come looking for a vault in my house.
I don't have a vault.
There's not one.
I don't have a vault. Nothing. This is very similar to a very popular book, Scott. What book is this?
I'm thinking about In Cold Blood and the Clutter Murders from 1958 in...
This is almost...
Holcomb, Kansas.
Eerily similar.
Yeah.
To that.
Well,
spoiler
that's
alert,
not the only
if
one.
If you've not read that book, this story is very similar.
Well... You know, we didn't give too much away. The book kind of starts out with the crime portion and then goes from there. So if you've never read In Cold Blood, first of all,
read it.
Yeah, do that today or at least get it started. But yeah, it's we've dealt with several cases like this since we started this podcast back in May that end up with or that start out with, it starts out as a crime, as a robbery, as a theft, and it escalates into something much worse.
And that's absolutely what happened. And I just want to focus. As we conclude this, I want to focus on our victim, Mr. Charles Newman, and the hero that he was.
Yeah.
World War II veteran, D-Day survivor, retired contractor, 80 years old. And again, the last thing he said is, come sit down with me, let me pray for you. I can't keep thinking about that.
Yeah. A guy that jumped out of
I can't stop thinking about that, I guess.
Perfectly good airplane in the early morning hours of June the 6th, 1944, to go and kill Germans to keep them from killing our boys who were walking onto the beaches of Normandy and probably saw some and did some horrible, horrible things while he was there in the name of God and country and God bless
him
for his service.
Lives to be 80 years old and this is what happens.
Last words.
It's quite amazing. It really does show how amazing he was. Mm-hmm. It's such a tragedy.
They did not call him the greatest generation for nothing.
Exactly. It is such a tragedy that this is how his life came to an end. And then Andrew has already been executed, like I said, in 2013. So, I mean, both of these people are gone. This is it.
Two deaths with absolutely nothing to show for it.
No. Mm-mm. No, nothing. It's such a tragedy. This is a sad case to me.
Yeah.
It's just senseless.
I mean, they're all sad. I'm not trying to say that they're not, but this one just... makes absolutely no sense to me, the whole thing. And I just, I hate it so bad. But I do want us to focus on what an amazing person that Mr. Newman was in his final hours.
Agreed. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's all we have for this episode on the Halloween Killer.
It was fantastic. Thank you.
This was a rough one to research.
Digging that out for us. That was
awesome. Really was rough to research. That's very sad. But thank you for joining us. And let us know your favorite crime. True Crime on Easy Street at gmail.com. We'll research it. We'll have it on.
Yes, we have gotten several submissions, and don't think that we're not working on them if we haven't got to something that you've let us know about.
That reminds me, shout-outs. Exactly. I have been instructed that if I don't give my coworker Luke Peek a shout-out today, I am on a list that I don't want to be on.
Thank you, Luke.
Luke is a new listener. He works over at Model T Screen Printing, where I have an office. And he says he has everybody in the back listening to our podcast.
That's awesome, just a couple of weeks.
So thumbs up, shout out for you, Luke. Thank you.
Hello, and thank you for listening.
Glad I remembered that because I was going to hear it tomorrow.
Well, I hope you all had a safe and happy Halloween. And we'll see you next week.
Good night, everybody.